This episode of The Big Interview was first broadcast on the 13th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Todd Brûlé, and this is The Big Interview here on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got to where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. My guest today is a graphic designer, painter, and art educator whose career over the past four decades has seen her design children's books, receive Grammy nominations for album covers, and become Pentagram New York's first female partner among 14 men. Paula Schur was born in Virginia in 1948, grew up in Philadelphia and Washington, D.C., and after studying illustration at the Tyler School of Art, very good name, moved to New York without a penny. Since then, Paula's clients have included Citibank, Microsoft, and the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, and she joins us today here in London. Paula Schur, thank you very much for joining us here on The Big Interview. I wanted to maybe start, of course, this, you know, we've had quite an extraordinary 2015. I think a lot of people who'll be listening to this interview, though, might want to treat this as a bit of a masterclass when it comes to design, when it comes to issues of branding. We spoke, well, not many years ago, but I think it was probably about a good 7 or 8 years ago when we sat down last time. And one of the topics we talked about was how brand really became so core to the discussion. The notion of branding entered, you know, boardrooms in a way like never before. And I'm wondering if you feel that's changed, if we've moved into a world where we've been overtaken by digital communications and certainly all of the things that have sort of erupted on the U.S. West Coast, more than where sort of, you know, the good old craft of brand used to sit.
Well, I think that the term branding is really changing. I mean, I think that organizations understand that they don't control everything, and that information is flowing from all different sources, that people confront things in different ways, and that what they want to do is have whatever it is they're making understood and appreciated in a positive light. That's impossible to control. So I think that they begin to look for alternative ways to communicate that are not what we're initially perceived as branding, but actually are the same thing. It's still that determined, can you control public opinion? Of course you can't. Mm. But you can behave in certain ways that improve the understanding of you or improve the perception of whatever you're doing. And I think that's what they all try to do now.
Mm. I feel there's this underlay now that, you know, whether it is someone in the CMO's office or it's an external consultant, but so often now, people want to talk about storytelling as if there was never a narrative that went with brand before. And you're sort of chuckling at this as well. But wasn't it always the case? Or do people feel that we need more underpinning than ever before? I mean, I think we've almost banned the word storytelling in this building. And if not, it'll certainly be gone, well within January next year.
I don't find things terribly different over 40 years, to be quite honest. Even the media has changed enormously. I think that essentially most organizations want to be able to control their messages, however the messages are telegraphed, and that what changes is how they're telegraphed. But the notion of saying something like storytelling is really talking about we want to control our dialogue, and that's what they want to do. And audiences are right to find ways to resist that, because otherwise they could be misled or controlled. And I think that's the natural ebb and flow of things. Mm. So that what is important for those of us who engage with clients to help them disseminate information is to find out how they can be recognized in the most positive way possible. Mm. And to get them to consider changing those things that may not be positive, which is part of what your role is. Mm.
One of the things I'm intrigued by today, or maybe even sometimes a little bit dismayed by when I look at brands, is maybe all of sort of the peel back and the reveal. I often think that very good brands are a little bit mysterious. And yet I think in this era of social media, that brands, and maybe by default we're talking about, of course, you know, the whole corporate structure, they want to talk about what they're doing every second of the day. Now, of course, as journalists, we want people to be transparent. But at the same time, I feel that I want to discover a business maybe in my own time, in my own terms. And I always feel that a good brand is part of, you know, 50% of it, I know the logo when mm-hmm. I see it. Mm-hmm. I know the scent and the smell, and I see the aircraft on the runway. But I don't know. I think the other 50% is a little bit, it's just in my head, and it's those great associations. But sometimes I get this sense that, you know, when you take me into the atelier and then I'm on, suddenly I'm listening to what the CFO or the CEO or whoever it is in whatever C-suite is doing on the golf course, it's not so sexy anymore.
Well, I'm always perturbed about who wants to know that anyway. I mean, I think other people have other things to do in their lives. But I think that what is driving some of that is that because there's so many different channels for discovery, organizations and corporations and people who make products can no longer be assured that someone's going to confront something a specific way. So they feel the need to be in every single channel. Mm. And maybe the channels, some of them are useless or pointless.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know. I'm always mystified by corporate Twitter accounts. I mean, who would believe that? It doesn't seem like a viable thing to listen to. But yet, I find that even Pentagram, my design firm, has enormous response to our Twitter account, and that's our own PR. So maybe in fact it works. I have no idea.
Mm. When you go in and sit down with a client, and maybe when it's a fresh engagement as well, how deep does the strategy go in terms of even saying, look, I think that you know, we need to be looking at these three or four channels when this launches, and only these three or four channels. How prescriptive is it? Or will you go as far as the client sort of demands in a way?
It depends upon the kind of business. I mean, they're really, businesses are very different. Businesses need very different things. And the businesses that come to me, depending upon their scale, need different levels of involvement. So primarily, I call myself an identity designer, meaning what an identity is how something is recognized and understood. So that while that touches messaging, because that's how things are understood, it is largely dependent on the kind of business. For example, if it's a theater organization, then I would say that all forms of communication and public media are very important because it's about buzz, what's going on, things get hot because you're talking about theater, which is very different than if somebody's making a T-shirt. I mean, they have different forms. It doesn't mean that the T-shirt can't have a form of hotness either, but it's a different kind of buzz. If you're talking about certain types of restaurants or food service businesses, what's fascinating is they develop very loyal followings if they do something terrific, so that you'll find people are very obsessive about them. And so all of a sudden, the Twitter accounts really matter, and in other types of businesses, they don't.
Mm.
It really depends upon what they're doing and how the audience is going to perceive it. It's not all equal.
Tell me, and it was interesting when you talked about, you know, even on, let's say, the comm side of Pentagram, they're using Twitter. Now, if suddenly I'm running a business, I want to reinvent my brand, and I decide to contact Pentagram either in New York or London, what happens as a first point of contact and engagement? Because you have this partnership approach. I guess there are fiefdoms in a way within that. How does the work get divvied up? I mean, if it just comes in a very neutral way, no one knows Paula necessarily versus another partner in the firm.
They do, actually.
They do.
In New York. I mean, in London, I think that's more or less true more recently. I think there are partners who maintain a client relationship with a group of people. Some of them always did. For example, my partner, John Rushworth, worked a very long period of time in the hotel industry and is very well known there and gets an enormous amount of business from that area.
But there's still cold calls, nevertheless.
They're cold calls, but they're actually not that
reasonably informed.
Most people have seen something, or they've heard about it in a specific way, and you can sort of trace it back to a partner. And I would say that the cold calls are the least interesting business generally, because they're usually people who are not terribly informed and therefore can be not great clients, or not people that They may be comparing us in a way to another firm that's not reasonable or that it's just not an informed decision. So I would say that the majority of our clients are fairly well educated, surprisingly so.
Let's rewind over the decades for a moment. If you look back at identity work, which, yeah, still gives you a tingle and think, yeah, and you think back that that was amazing when we had the first discussion with the client to the moment there was the reveal. What's still outstanding in your mind?
Well, it's interesting because I actually think everything exists in its time, and that the things that I truly like are things that I've updated. Because I've been designing the Public Theater for 24 years. I've redesigned their logo 3 times, and nobody knows it because it's like tailoring. You tailor to your moment in time. If you don't tailor it, it's going to get flabby. Mm. What's wonderful is when I can maintain the relationship and get revisited, so I can update it. Interestingly enough, you know, the Highline, which was designed in 2000, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the identity, but we need to revisit the communications program. I think that there was a tendency, particularly in not-for-profit organizations, to be so proud of the fact that things look consistent and were orderly and branded that they became overly branded and don't have enough expression. So you have to go back and look at programs and figure out how you change the tone of voice so there isn't this repetitive sameness about it. And that is part of the process as well. And I also like the notion of in-house art departments in places where I've designed identities, where the things get to live and breathe because you have a relationship with the people who are actually producing it over a period of time. And I try to do that with museums, and I try to do that with corporations that have used my work and grown it. And I think that that's fantastic.
We also have to go, I guess, to the other side of the table and the talent, of course, that needs to be deployed to deliver the end identity. And you said in many ways, not much has changed over the decades. But what about the nature of recruitment? And I sort of feel whether I'm looking at new designers for the magazine or our agency as well, in one sense, everything perhaps looks better. And there is an approach of, what is an identity going to look like on an iPad today? And how is it going to be applied to a vehicle? And what does it look like on the top of a building? And it can all look, delightful and wonderful. And at least the editing process, is it a bit more difficult because everything can somehow arrive in a much more polished state? Are there more smoke and mirrors today? I mean, my feeling is yes. And yet somehow I still feel, though, I can see through it a little bit, no matter how polished it is, that there's something sort of underlying it if it's good enough. Not always right. Of course, someone brings in all of their work and it all falls apart. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, but for someone who's such a seasoned pro as you, does it become more difficult in the digital age?
Well, first of all, the students who come out of design school are so well-versed in all forms of communication. I'm totally impressed and wondered if I could have done it at their age and learned what they've learned. I teach, and I teach a senior portfolio class at School of Visual Arts. I've taught it for years. And so many of the people who've worked for me have either come through my class or come through recommended by other students. So I think it's very important if you're a working professional to be very close to what's happening in the education system. And they adapt to visual languages very naturally now. I happen to be teaching a group of students who all invent alphabets for every single project. So, and they know how to program them. They're quite amazing. What I teach is really visual language. I mean, I wouldn't even talk about it purely as the common notion of a logo attached to something, which is sort of what you were describing. Because the media is so diverse, you need to be recognized in every form, but you can't be completely repetitive by hammering a logo on everything. You actually have to be able to be recognized even if there isn't a logo, that there's some tone of voice, that there's some visual inflection that you recognize and you understand as a specific thing. And that's really what we're doing. And then the medium becomes irrelevant because you can begin to accommodate for anything within this broad language. Like, you can understand me in person or you can understand me on the radio. What is the difference? It's still the same person. Yet, even if you don't see me, you recognize a tone of voice or an inflection or some such thing. It's really the same thing with identity.
When you look around the branded landscape today and let's be neutral here, and really sort of address anything that's out there. Who do you respect when you look at sort of work that you've seen? Yeah, and maybe something that will also resonate with you. Maybe things that which have been updated or refreshed, and some things that are very much within our contemporary landscape, Paula, that you think they've really nailed it. This is a brand that really gets it right. You know, and whether that's, you know, it doesn't matter if we're looking across tarmacs of airports or through malls or something in between.
You know, this is a very difficult question for me because
I
always blank out. And I think it's because there is very little I find surprising, and that is depressing.
Yeah, I was going to say that's hugely disappointed in someone in your position driving to the airport or wherever you're going that little is standing out.
Because I understand how it works so well.
Sure.
That I see it and I'm not enthralled by it. I think where I become excited is when I walk into a culture I don't understand. Like, I've always been tremendously inspired by both Japanese and Chinese work, largely because I can't read the language. So I don't understand the manipulation, and I'm bombarded by something that's amazingly graphic and wonderful, and I find that experience to be really terrific. I think that as somebody who can analyze something I understand so immediately, it sort of destroys the novelty of it. It's not that I'm being coy here. I just absolutely can't think of it.
No, but I'm fascinated because you want to somehow... In one way, you want the recognition of what, and even the excitement of when you understand a brand, but you don't mind if there's a bit of decoding then to get there.
I love the decoding. The problem is if I get it, I'm not interested in it. It's when I don't get it or that I look at something and this is the thing that I've always been against in relationship to research. If you confront something that's new and exciting, you don't necessarily have a positive response to it, you're going to ask questions like, what is that? And that's the moment I look for, where you're saying, what am I looking at? What's going on here? This is interesting. What's happening? And that's hard for me to find because I understand how everything works. If you don't understand how everything works, you may be having moments like that all the time.
Right.
But because I can look at any form of campaign and sort of unravel it, it has no mystery to me. That's why I think the language thing is always exciting, because I'll know or get the sensibility that something's happening, but because I can't read, I can't figure out how it's actually being structured. I remember feeling that way the first time I saw Uniqlo. I thought that was an amazing, you're going back, 12, 15 years. I don't remember quite how old it was. But I remember the first time I saw it, I said, wow, something is happening here with this brand visually. And originally, it felt very Japanese. Now it feels very American to me. But at that point in time, when I first confronted it, I thought it was amazing.
I want to come back, because you've got a bit of a tie-up with Uniqlo at the moment.
Yes.
As well, which...
Well, that's accidental, actually.
Yeah, no, I know. well, I think all these relationships, you know, always start for a reason. But are we then in an era as well where everything, you know, has been so simplified, and maybe within boardrooms and of course within publicly traded companies, there just has to be a level of ass covering today that everything is understood, because someone goes on the tennis court one day with a shareholder and they say, you know, I looked at that new logo and I don't understand it. Very difficult then for the CEO or CMO to say, well, that was the whole point. And the shareholder says, well, you know, when I was talking to our analysts, you know, they didn't understand it either. And then someone's job is on the line. But are we in a bit of a place that there aren't as many risk takers, and everything has to be distilled to instant recognition and not those wow moments or just the big question mark?
Social media has also done this even more than analysts on a golf course. That always existed. But it's you can change your logo and be bombarded in social media, because essentially, if you consider the sort of blogosphere, the nature of responding to something new is always going to be reactionary. I mean, because it really goes back to what I was talking about before. If you're confronted with something new, you have to ask questions, not give answers, because you have to say, what is that? Why does that work? Is that interesting? Does that work? Somebody confronted with something they know that changes is the most instantaneous response if you ask them is, I don't get it, I don't like it.
Mm.
You know, that it takes time to see. So it's harder in many ways to make something new be accepted, and it's harder in many ways to make something new, period,
Full stop.
There's so much around.
I'm intrigued by maybe the therapy session that sometimes needs to happen with a new client. And you know, is there a moment where there's a cup of tea or a cozy drink in a bar where we say to the client, listen, you know, we are going to go on a bit of a journey together, and there's going to be a lot of chatter, and it could be around your breakfast table or it could be around your boardroom table, and there'll be a lot of things that are going to exist digitally, but go with your gut. You know, this is why we're here together. Is that a moment that is important that has to happen, or is an identity always going to go on trial and someone is going to be persuaded because there's just this overwhelming amount of chatter, or do we still find good clients today that just say, I don't give a stuff, you know, we're going with it, and that's all there is to it?
We definitely do find clients like that. There are clients today that say, I don't give a snuff, I'm going to go with it, and that's all there is to it. They will do that largely when they are ready to buy design. In other words, you have to be ready to do it. Sometimes there are massive processes they go through to prepare themselves, whether it's discovering who they are, going through long strategy sessions, comparing themselves to other organizations. But there is a moment where somebody is ready to make a decision. And they will know going into it that they have to hold to it and hold firmly, because otherwise they are not in the position to make the decision. Because something new is risky, and it's easier not to do it. So when they've decided to do it, they are completely ready to stand behind it, which is great. But mostly, the relationships are strong when you go through the process. That the point in time they've made the commitment to hire you, which is what I see taking longer. It's not so much that the design process is harder. It's that getting hired in many respects is harder, because they want to be sure that the relationship is really going to work and that they can trust the relationship to bring them a result that they're going to feel good about and want to support. And that usually has to do with first being ready to make the change.
Mm.
They cannot approach the process without being ready to make the change. Secondly, to determine based on the sort of relationship they form with me or one of my partners in the organization, that we are working in their interests, and the belief that everything that we've shown them, every area that we explore, any revision we make, anything we recommend is existing for their benefit, not for our benefit, and that's part of the relationship. They have to feel that way, and we have to feel that way. So we'll sometimes say, you know, if they want to do something and we don't feel it's the right thing to do, we'll tell them very loudly and clearly and why. If they want us to do something that we think is inherently wrong, we may resign the project. If they don't feel that they've gotten enough out of us moving us forward, we'll try to respond to that in every way we can.
Mm.
So that it's we're their consultant, their doctor, and working on their behalf.
How often when you go through a round of let's say a first round presentation with a client, do you nail it in one? That of course you still might go through all the therapy and everything else and go through work, but you actually end up back at square one. That actually what they saw the first time is actually what they loved. Is it 50-50, 60-40?
Well, it's even worse than that, actually, because very often my first idea is my best idea, and then I have a lot of trouble building back the rest of the presentation, because I want to at least appear, if nothing else, to have explored other possibilities. So it's embarrassing.
It's a bit of back fiction, yeah.
You know? but you know, there are occasions when I do and I find something better. But I have to say, within a first presentation, which is what the first part of phase one is, after we've done our research, we generally are coming back with some initial recommendations, and by and large, there's something where the heart of it is in that first presentation. It may modify itself, and it may modify itself to suit all kinds of things, but it's there.
Mm.
And generally, if it isn't there, it's hard to back in on a second one, I would say. There's a piece of it. If I show three things, and they're generally three very disparate things, you know, so that they're different directions, and there's always a desire somehow to find something in the middle.
Mm.
And sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't.
Mm.
But it's generally, if you look at the beginning of any design presentation, if I go back historically, it's there. And sometimes there's only one.
Mm. Finally, we are, of course, probably at the almost at the apex of the biggest consumer time of year. We mentioned Uniqlo a little bit earlier, and I got an invite a few weeks ago. I wasn't in New York, and I said to the PR that I would have loved to have come along. What would I have seen? What is the Uniqlo adventure?
The Uniqlo T-shirts have nothing to do with me. I didn't design them. They approached, and I find this really fascinating because it's actually a new one on me. They approached me as an artist, not as a designer, to collect work I had previously done and use it on T-shirts. Now, they do that with Keith Haring, and they do it with Basquiat, and they've just recently started to do it with designers. They did it with me and with Experimental Jet Set, and they launched these graphic design collections of projects that were designed for other things, so that one form of commerciality is then used on this other form, and it becomes fashion. And then the meaning is devoid because it's no longer promoting a project. It's moved into another cultural realm.
Mm.
And I actually kind of found it fascinating. A couple of them make very good T-shirts. And the T-shirts are not, but the work is typographic. And the T-shirts become backdrops for patterning of this typography, which is a lot of fun. And one of them is one of my paintings. But what was amusing to me is some of them were originally T-shirts. In other words, some of the designs, it might have been a poster promoting something for the music industry, and it was a T-shirt in its day. It wasn't a T-shirt as a piece of fashion. It was a T-shirt that was a promotional T-shirt. So they become full cycle, and they have no meaning because the event is long over and nobody remembers it. There's one T-shirt that was for a Broadway show called Wild Party. That is, it's my favorite T-shirt in the series. The show was an utter failure and it closed, but the T-shirt's great. It was never used as a T-shirt, by the way. That show wasn't open long enough to have a
really?
T-shirt. But it is this cacophony of typography that is cropped into, and it actually looks wonderful as a piece of clothing.
Nevertheless, so, any pickup or recognition from people who might have remembered the party?
I don't think anybody would remember this. I mean, and I as a piece of my work, it's actually not that well known because the show wasn't a hit. But as sort of an object of type, especially as patterning, it's fantastic on a shirt. That's all I can say. It wasn't designed for a shirt. So I can't say that this relationship is something that I went after. It was an odd request for this line of T-shirts that we're going to sell for Christmas, which are in the stores right now. When I went and saw them in place, and they had, it's a tie-in they do with MoMA, and they take artists that are collected by the Museum of Modern Art, and they do a cross promotion, and that's the basis for them. And then at the Uniqlo store on Fifth Avenue, they have the T-shirts displayed by these really lovely behind these lovely glass cases, and it's quite funny. I enjoyed it, but I like that this form of promotional culture then becomes object.
Mm.
And I thought that was wonderful.
Paula Scher, wonderful talking to you. Thanks very much for joining us on The Big Interview here on Monocle 24.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Tyler Brulé, in conversation with Paula Scher of Pentagram. The Big Interview is produced and edited by Bill Lutti and researched by Gaia Lutz. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programs here at Monocle 24. And of course, they can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, and of course, at monocle.com. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye for me. Thank you.